30점대인데 아니 자리야 가사다 전제 아니 30점대니.
It's been since the Buddha came to India and gave his teaching, the teaching spread to many different countries. And in Asia, although the different countries in Asia went through lots of difficulties, we have kept our traditional religion for over 1,000 years. So I'd like to thank you. In the past, we didn't have much connection with each other. But in this new century, it has become easier for us to communicate and to connect to each other. And then regarding recently scholars from Sri Lanka, Burma, Korea, Vietnam, Japanese, and so forth, the connection and the between people of these countries, as well as Thailand and so forth, are increasing. And this is very important. We are all followers of the same teacher, one teacher. Regarding the Pali tradition, followers of the Pali tradition, and we share the Vinaya practice with them. And then regarding the Sanskrit, followers of the Sanskrit tradition, we also have the same practice of the professional wisdom teachings. So, as followers of the same teacher, the disciples, students of the same teacher, it's very important for us to share our knowledge with one another. And in our monastic, great monastic centers of learning, we have started having discussions on the monastic discipline between our tradition and the other monastic Vinaya traditions. So this is very important, Vinaya being the basis of the teaching of the Buddha. In the 1960s, perhaps, when I first visited Singapore and Thailand, Singapore, there were elderly Chinese monks who recited the Heart Sutra in Chinese. So that was the first time I heard this recitation of this sutra in Chinese. I felt really sad and thought that in the past, how many have recited the same sutra in the past? And I visited many different cities and towns in China proper in the past, but there was none who recited the Heart Sutra at that time. So I thought, so despite all the hardships we have faced, we have kept up with our traditional religion, and I would like to thank everyone for that. I prostrate the mother of the Saint Old Buddhas of the three times, which is ineffable, the perfection of wisdom, which is inexpressible, inconceivable, and beyond words, which is unborn, unceasing, and in the nature of space.
Oh, yeah.
So, to the Buddha, Dharma, and Supreme Assembly, I take refuge until enlightenment. But listening to the teaching, by accumulating merit and wisdom, by listening to the teaching, may I become a Buddha to benefit all wandering beings. This is repeated three times. To the Buddha, Dharma, and Supreme Assembly, I take refuge until enlightenment. By the merit and wisdom gained through listening to the teaching, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I pay homage to the Gautama, who, moved by his compassion, taught the sacred Dharma to rid us of all distorted views. So, it is said by Master Nagarjuna, perhaps it was a verse of salutation in the 60 stanzas of reasoning or somewhere at the end of this. May I be able to complete the accumulation of merit and wisdom through this virtue, and through these two accumulations, may I attain the two Buddha bodies. And so the goal that we are seeking is the stage of omniscience, the Buddhahood, and the means to reach that is, as we came across in the Bhavanakrama, the stages of meditation, where it said that a result must come from a compatible cause which can give rise to it, and therefore the compounded phenomena, even at the Buddha's level, must come through their compatible causes, just as other effects must come from their compatible causes. And so we cannot have some other cause which cannot give rise to that of the qualities of Buddha. And regarding the attainment, the resultant stage, we have the Dharmakaya and the Rupakaya, the truth body and the form body. And then these two in turn could be divided into five or four Buddha bodies. And in the Mahayana Uttara Tantra, it mentions that we have the basic potential for attaining this Buddhahood, which is the Buddhahood. And so with regard to the Buddha nature, so we have the naturally abiding Buddha potential and those of the progressive Buddha potentials for progressing along the path. And so, by using these, we need to accumulate the accumulation of merit and wisdom in order to attain the Rupakaya by merit and through merit and this Dhammakaya through the wisdom. So, impelled by the bodhicitta, we need to attain or we need to cultivate those causes which lead us to Rupakaya, which comes through the accumulation of merit. And then for the Dharmakaya, first we need to develop the understanding of the gross, gain the gross understanding of selflessness, and then enter into this more subtle insight into emptiness. So, as it is taught in the Perfection of Wisdom teachings, that of emptiness, is the Heart Sutra, which says that all the five aggregates must also be seen as empty by nature. And therefore, in order to reach that understanding that of that subtle selflessness, we must first build our understanding from the gross forms of selflessness. And for that, we need first to engage in learning what emptiness or selflessness is, and then having studied it, then we need to reflect on it and gain conviction in this, in the meaning of selflessness, and then put effort in meditation so that you, through your effort and endeavor, you are able to build your experience of selflessness. So, regarding the resultant, there are the two holy Buddha bodies, which are the Rupakaya and the Dharmakaya. And so that is our goal. So, regarding these, the means to reach that goal of the Rupakaya and Dharmakaya, we have those of the Bodhicitta, the spirit of enlightenment, and the view of emptiness, which must be first studied, then reflected upon, and gain conviction in, and then applied in meditation to progress along that path. So all the scriptures are meant for, directly or indirectly meant for, the development of bodhicitta and the wisdom of emptiness. And then tantric deity yoga practices are grounded in these two principles as the basis of our practice. So, regarding the Kanjur and Tenjur literature, which comprise over 300 volumes, so with regard to the practice of bodhicitta, distilling all these messages in the Kanjur and Tenjur, the greatest text is the Bodhisattva Charya Avatara, Guided Bodhisattva Way of Life. As Kunalama Rinpoche Tenzin Gyatso used to tell me, since it was written, there has never been a greater text for the cultivation and practice of bodhicitta, the spirit of enlightenment, than Bodhisattva Charya Avatara. And then we will come across the wisdom chapter today in this text. Although it is not so extensively covered regarding the view of emptiness, in order to understand the emptiness taught in it well, we need to study Master Nagarjuna's six treatises of reasoning. And then also, as a supplement to this, to the Mula Madhyamaka Karika and other texts by Nagarjuna, we have the 400 verses by Master Aryadeva. And Buddha Palita has written a short commentary on the Mula Madhyamaka Karika called Buddha Palita Commentary. And then Bhavaviveka wrote the Lamp of Wisdom, in which he actually raised qualms in terms of in his interpretation, in the interpretations of Buddha Palita. And then Master Chandrakirti came and he wrote the text, such as the Prasanapada commentary and Madhyamaka Avatara, to clarify the interpretation of Buddha Palita and so forth. And so there are all these arguments back and forth between or amongst these different scholars. And basically, it is important for us to study Madhyamaka, these three texts, Mula Madhyamaka, by then 400 verses, and the Madhyamaka Avatara by Chandrakirti. So without studying the other Madhyamaka texts like these, just by reading and studying the Shantideva's 10th chapter on wisdom will not give you a full understanding of of the Madhyamaka view of emptiness. And so, in regarding the teaching of the Guide to a Bodhisattva Way of Life, we are on verse number 153 of the meditation chapter, I think. So, in this text, we came across seeing the disadvantage of self-cherishing attitude, and now we have come to the point of really piercing through this self-cherishing attitude to destroy it. And so, verse number 154, what does the self-cherishing attitude do is try to disregard the welfare of other sentient beings, happiness of other sentient beings, and you try, with this attitude, you try to achieve your own goal. So in the case of those Shravakas and so forth who may not disregard that of the welfare of other sentient beings as such, but they are not so interested to serve, to work for the well-being of others. And therefore, even if they reach their liberation, nirvana, they have not been able to, they are fully accomplish their goal completely. So while we have all the different facilities and conditions, we should be aware that self-cherishing attitude will never bring the full. Let us have the accomplish our goals fully, but partially, and in the end, it actually causes ruin to the person who is self-cherishing. And therefore, the text says on the third line. 154, for hundreds of times in this cycle of rebirth, he has caused harm to me. So even with regard to the Pratyeka Buddhas and Shravakas, they will reach that of the nirvana, which is by which they are actually fallen in the peace, extreme of peace. So because of desiring to benefit yourself, O mind, all the weariness you have gone through over countless past eons has only succeeded in achieving misery. Therefore, I shall definitely engage myself in working for the benefit of others, for since the words of the mighty ones are infallible, I shall behold its advantage in the future. And to verse number 157 and 58 also read, so if you are able to, if you had cultivated cherishing others over yourself in the past lives, at least you won't be in the situation that you are now. But because of being obsessed with self-cherishing attitude and disregarding others' welfare, we are where we are in this pathetic condition. And therefore, now,
to
So the text says, therefore, I shall definitely engage myself in working for the benefit of others. For the sins, the words of the mighty ones are infallible. I shall behold its advantages in the future. So now that you have attained a human life, if you could put all your effort in developing, cherishing others over yourself, in developing this altruistic attitude, if in the past I had practiced this act of exchanging self and others, a situation such as this is devoid of magnificence and bliss of the Buddha could not possibly have come about. Therefore, just as I have come to hold as I these drops of sperms and blood others, likewise through acquaintance I should be also come to regard all others. And then the next verse. So, with short-sightedness and narrow-mindedness and self-cherishing attitude, I mean, you should try to see the disadvantage and try to open yourself up to cultivate cherishing others over yourself. So, this one, 160 is actually teaching us how to open ourselves up to cherish others over oneself so that you would be able to cause more happiness for yourself. I'm happy, but others are sad. I'm high, though others are low. I benefit myself, but others. Why am I not envious of myself? I must separate myself from happiness and take upon myself the suffering of others. Why am I doing this now? In this way, I should examine myself for faults. Although others may do something wrong, I should transform it into a fault of my own. But should I do something even slightly wrong, I shall openly admit it to many people. So verse number 166. I should not be dominating and aggressive. So these are showing the disadvantages of self-cherishing attitude, acting in self-righteous, arrogant way. Instead, like a newly married bride, I should be beautiful, timid, and bashful, restrained. So far, you have not seen that cherishing others over oneself is the source of all your good and benefit and happiness for this life as well as in the next lives. And therefore, we have been obsessing with self-cherishing attitude. And so, having heard the teaching of the Buddha, now we should be able to see the pros and cons of self-cherishing attitude and cherishing others. So now I see you, 169 says, now I see your nature and your faults, and wherever you go, I shall destroy your arrogance. I should immediately cast aside all thoughts to work for my own sake. By having sold you to others, I shall not become discouraged, but shall offer up all your strength to others. If, having become conscientious, I do not give you to all living beings, it is certain that you will deliver me to the guardians of the hells. For ages have you dealt with me like this, and I have suffered long. But now, recalling all my grudges, I shall overcome your selfish thought. Likewise, if I wish to be happy, I should not be happy with myself. And similarly, if I wish to be protected, I should constantly protect all others. To whatever degree I take great care of this body, so his Holiness was commenting on verse 176. Being unable to fulfill them, though desiring to do so, disturbing conceptions and dissatisfied mind will ensue. So, but if I do not depend on any material things, the exhaustion of my good fortune will be unknown. So 180 finished. 181. Please read through. So verse number 180, then the last line said, why then am I so attached to it? So because this body is so physical, so gross and coarse, we have this kind of attachment to our body. So earlier we came across the point of giving our body to others needs lots of other conditions that we need to fulfill. So until then, we do not give our body. Once we have, and therefore what we need to practice is that of the sense of giving to others so that we can overcome the stinginess. So I should look after it while experiencing the results of my previous actions. So therefore, in order to benefit all beings, I shall give up this body without any attachment, but although it may have many faults, I should look after it while experiencing the results of my previous actions. And so next verse shows that we are so short-sighted and narrow-minded, and therefore we only look for the temporary benefit and then satisfied with it. And so now enough is this childish behavior, it says. I shall follow in the steps of the wise, and having recalled the advice concerning conscientiousness, I shall turn away sleep and mental dullness. Just like the compassionate sons of the conqueror, I shall patiently accept what I have to do. For if I do not make a constant effort day and night, when will my misery ever come to an end? Therefore, in order to dispel the obscurations, I shall withdraw my mind from mistaken ways and constantly place in equipoise upon the perfect object. This completes the eighth chapter on meditation. And so now we are on chapter 9, as I already covered some of the verses earlier in the beginning of the teaching. The sages propounded or taught all these branches of teaching for the sake of promoting, for the sake of wisdom. Therefore, those who wish to pacify suffering should generate wisdom. So in the teaching of the Buddha started his teaching of the Noble, Four Noble Truths by teaching on suffering. And suffering is rooted in ignorance. And therefore, in order to overcome suffering, we need to develop the understanding and wisdom, the understanding of the two truths, which are the conventional and the ultimate. These, as the text says, these are accepted as being the two truths. The ultimate is the direct object of, not the direct object of mind, and the dualistic mind is spoken of as conventional. In the light of that, the world is seen to be two types, yogis and common people. So in the world, there are numerous, innumerable other animals who lack the human intelligence. And so we can only do prayers for them and nothing much, as I have already explained before. But we can still, the human beings are the ones for whom we can think of doing something for them and keep our hope to do something for them. And the human beings on this earth, within the human beings, there are two types, it says, yogis and the world seems to be two types, yogis and common people. So yogis means those who yoke their mind with the correct or the right object. So otherwise, merely getting lost in the pleasures drawn on the basis of sensual, the sensory experiences are like animals. So although you may have a human body, but because of your behavior, you are almost like animals. So those who are thinking only in materialistic terms of living their life are like that. Although I may be, it may be too much for me to say this, but so as human beings who have this mind, this intelligence, I mean, we should to try not to be like animals, but make this life a meaningful one. And especially those who are educated, I mean, we should not just remain should not remain uncritical, but try to analyze things and see what's the nature of things, how they arise, and so forth. And so the scientists who do this kind of critical analysis into the nature of things and reality could be considered yogis because of this their critical analysis into the and investigation into the nature of things. Whereas common people who do not do this kind of critical analysis are those considered as common. And so they are, it says, and regarding that the world common people is undermined by the world of the yogis. Because the yogis are those who do analytical analysis and investigation into things. Their mental capacity or mental thinking is higher. And through differences in their intelligence, the views of the yogis too are undermined by progressively higher ones. So regarding the scientists, for example, there are scientific findings on which they come across through their investigation and analysis and research. And therefore, there are a lot of knowledge that we can learn from them. And then there are scientists who are beginning to pay more attention to the inner world of mind as well. And so those who are materialistically oriented, I met a Japanese scientist in Japan one time, and he did not accept a mind apart from the brain. But then he has lots of worries because of some problem in his family. So if the mind is only the brain, then he could have done some surgery on his brain and taken out the part which gives this kind of worry. But I did not say to him, though I felt like that. So if there is no, I mean, since he did not accept a mind apart from the brain, I mean, I just felt like that, although I didn't say it to him. So with regard to the inner world of mind, the ancient Indian psychology could actually undermine the views of the scientists, the modern scientists, with regard to the understanding of the mind. And then, with regard to philosophical views, those who assert some permanent, single, and autonomous self or Atman could be undermined by those who can refute this kind of position. Because when we talk about old age, becoming sick, and so forth, we relate them in relation to the body. But if the self were different or separate an entity from the body, we cannot talk about ourselves feeling sick or and so forth.
Number
And with regard to another philosophical idea of a self, there are those philosophical schools which assert that the person is not the body, but then some aspect of the mind as the person or the being. As Paul Viveka says, that we accept that the mental, the mind is the, or the consciousness is the self, because it goes from one life to the next and so forth. And so these kind of views, I mean, the people who hold these kind of views could be undermined by the ones who reject any objective existence of a self. So in this way, the within the philosophical purview, the yogis could, with the lower views, could be undermined by the high yogis with higher views. And then with regard to the beings on the path, the understanding of emptiness, for example, within the beings who are on the path of accumulation could be undermined or inferior to those of the beings on the path of preparation. And then within, I mean, the bodhisattvas, for example, on the grounds, bodhisattva grounds, the higher, those on the higher bodhisattva grounds are undermined or by the undermined, the higher ones are undermined the lower ones. So here it is not, I mean, undermining does not refer to using some kind of a weapon like sticks or something like that, but their understanding and their views are undermined through reason. So if you state such and such, I would use this reasoning, and therefore this reasoning undermines your philosophical view, is how the philosophical schools undermine the others who are lower. And so point out the inconsistencies and contradictions within the other view, philosophical schools. And therefore, the Madhyamakas who reject any and all objective existence, whether it's external objects or a person, I mean, nothing could be pinpointed as being the person from amongst the aggregates. For example, even the Buddha cannot be found within the Buddha's mind and the body, and also the Dharma and Sangha cannot be found. When you do this kind of critical analysis, but despite the fact that things do not have any objective independent existence, they do affect us. For example, the view of emptiness, the understanding of emptiness, though it cannot be found when you put it under the lens of critical analysis, yet it functions to overcome ignorance and so forth. And so they are... So the common world seen functional things and conceives them to be truly existent. No, that by means of examples accepted by both, emptiness is established, unanalyzed, the practitioners engage in training for the sake of the result, and the common world sees functional things and conceives them to be truly existent. So what the common people say is that we actually see them. These are tangible things. And they ask, what do you mean by things do not have having no objective existence? So to this, the text replies, even direct perceptions and forms of form and so on only view conventionalities and are not valid cognitions. So for quantum physicists today would even say that when you actually dissect a flower, you cannot have a flower, any flower objectively existing. Although there is a flower, when we do not do any kind of this philosophical inquiry into its nature, Though the flower is merely designated and its existence is posited or asserted by way of designation, yet to us it does not, a flower does not appear to be designated, but we conceive of it, we conceive that it has some objective independent existence. So the fact that flower exists and so forth, and flowers and so forth, they exist by way of convention and not through some valid cognition or... And then with regard to when we talk about emptiness, the object of negation... with regard to that object of negation, there are degrees of subtlety between the views of the Madhyamakas who accept some objective existence and those Madhyamakas who reject any and all objective existence. So the former say that things and existence is that. Something exists when there is an object out there and a valid knowledge of that or cognition of it. So together they give the existence or identity of an object, and therefore they say that there is something objectively existing, and things are not merely designated. So of course, when I look at you, the Sangha here and the people here exist, but although things are conventionally existent, and that conventionality cannot be undermined by any other convention as such, yet and also that they are not undermined by any ultimate analysis in the nature of things. But although we can establish things in convention like that, yet when you look at things, they do appear to have some objective existence. So when I look at you, you appear to have objective existence, and accordingly, I too conceive some objective existence of you. And you, when you look at me, you see my body, and when you hear my voice, you could infer to a certain degree that, His Holiness Dalai Lama is thinking such and such. His thought goes along this and this line. But if you ask where the Dalai Lama is, apart from the body, speech, and the mind, where is the Dalai Lama? And you may point to me, he's up there on the throne, but this is my body that you see. But with regard to the body itself, do you actually mean my head or my body and hands, or hands are me? No. So when you actually go through this kind of critical analysis and dissect me, you will not find me. We'll come across these kind of analysis later also when we do the mindfulness meditation. So when you do this kind of critical analysis, nothing can be found. But without doing any analysis into the nature of the things, as convention, we could still say things exist, as Master Chandrakirti says in Madhyamaka Avatara, that when you do the sevenfold, when you actually examine something through the sevenfold reasoning, nothing can be found. Yet conventionally things exist. So this is when we look at things, they do appear to have some objective independent existence, and that is what is known as the object of negation, that which is to be refuted when you establish the view of emptiness. So even Madhyamakas, some Madhyamakas would say that a self or a person does exist, a being does exist, because we have the sense of I, this natural sense of I. And when they say that, they actually are referring to some kind of self-sufficiently, substantially existent self. And then, according to the different views of emptiness and the philosophical views of selflessness, there's also the difference in the determination of what constitutes valid cognition and whether valid cognition is mistaken or could be a mistaken cognition or not, and so forth. So, for example, for the Prasangika Madhyamakas who reject any and all objectification of things and self, they say that when we perceive a color like a blue color or some form, there is a perception of that object, and within that perception, we can say that it is mistaken, but mistaken in terms of the object of negation appearing to it, whereas with regard to the object itself that it perceives, that it sees the form or the color, it's not mistaken as such. Therefore, you can have a valid cognition. So when we say that something is impermanent and so forth, we are not saying, the Prasangika say that the impermanent nature is not the final nature of the object. And we are not saying that, although we can say it's one kind of an aspect of the nature of things. So verse number 7. So verse number 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. In muttering illusory person and so on and so forth. So verse number 12, done. So with regard to the in Nirvana, there are different types of Nirvana that are mentioned in the text. The natural Nirvana, which refers to the emptiness of the nature of the mind itself. And because we are ignorant of this nature of our mind, we are bound in samsara. But once you overcome this ignorance about this final nature of the mind and the beings, then you will be able to overcome the delusions within our mind and become enlightened or liberated. And so within that liberation, again, we have those liberation with residue and without residue. Verse number 15 is a rejection or refutation of the objections of Chittamatrans, the proponents of mind on his school. Suppose, like the Chittamatrans, you then ask, when even the deceptive awareness of it doesn't truly exist, by what is the illusion apprehended? Well, since according to you the illusion itself does not externally exist, then what is being apprehended? Suppose you answer, in actuality, it exists as something else, the aspect of which is the very mind itself. Well, then mind itself is like an illusion. Then what is being seen by what? The guardian of the world, in fact, said, mind cannot see mind, just as the edge of the sword, a sword cannot cut itself. So it is with the mind. So the mind on his school does not accept any externally that things externally exist. As quantum physicists also say, that as long as there is an observer, observing mind, there is that we can talk about this or that thing. Whereas when the observer is no more there, you cannot talk about the things existing. Whereas now here the Chittamatrins, the mind only school, assert that as long as a mind exists, and because of the imprint on the mind, the things that are seen and perceived by our senses are reflected, I mean, a reflection of that imprint on the mind, and therefore they exist. And apart from that imprint and the reflection of the mind, the imprint, they cannot exist. And therefore the Madhyamakas refute this position. So those who assert objective existence and things, even in convention, so we, when we start learning logic in monastic institutions, studying collective topics, the definition of something existing is given as that which is perceived by a valid cognition or valid knowledge. Whereas those of the schools which deny any objective existence say that an object exists in relation to the perception of it, and the perception of that object exists in relation to the object itself, and therefore they are mutually dependent. So whereas for those of the schools which assert some objective existence and things, they say the fact that a thing can be said to exist is because of a valid cognition of it. And if you ask them, if you press them, I mean, how do you prove that the mind or the cognition exists? And then they say, oh, there is a self-perception or apperception, and because of it, the mind can be said to exist. So verse number 23 says, but if a self-cognizing mind does not exist, then how can a consciousness be recalled? And so those who assert the self-cognition or rangrik say that there is a memory of what we have seen and memory of the cognition of a blue color and the object blue. And so they say that on the basis of that memory that they try to prove that there is self-perception. Because for them, unless they say that they're self-cognizing mind, they would have to go, I mean, it were the seeing something with the perception. To say that there is a perception, another perception and so forth, would be regressive logic. Well, a recollection comes about from a connection with another object that is experienced, like the poison from a rat. But it can be eliminated itself. It can eliminate itself because when endowed with other conditions, one sees the mind. Well, by means of applying magical eye illusion, a buried treasure of vase is seen, while the eye illusion itself not seen. Those which are seen, heard, or known are not to be negated. So the Madhyamakas, even those Madhyamakas who reject any objective existence and things, do not deny the existence of what is seen or heard and known. But what they are trying to negate or refute is the object which is apprehended by these grasping at some true existence.
because of this true, the grasping at true existence, that we have the exaggerated way of looking at things, which is like fantasizing. And accordingly, we have attachment and anger and all these other negative emotions. And therefore, this understanding of emptiness is meant for undermining and overcoming these negative emotions and the exaggerated outlook, and then the grasping at self. So here, instead of conception of true existence, which is the cause of suffering, it is to be rejected. The illusion of external objects is not separate from the mind. Despite being inseparable, it is still impermanent. So for those who assert that there is some objective existence, they say that the person is designated, whereas the designation, basis of the designation, have some substantial existence. And therefore, these designations are based on the substantial phenomena. So we are on verse number 31. So Madhyamaka Avatara says that there's no being, a person or self, apart from being designated on the basis of the aggregates. Although there are some schools which assert the aggregates are self, and some others say the inexpressible and self and so forth. But with regard to this, his inclination towards emptiness is still weak. With regard to, in relation to this, so schools which reject the what the non-Buddhist says, that is to say that there is no self or Atman, which is defined as being single, permanent, and autonomous. I mean, just by rejecting this kind of a self is not the final view of Madhyamaka as such. It does not overcome our negative emotions as such, and even asserting selflessness of a person according to the Vaibhashikas and Svatantikas, who do not assert selflessness of phenomena as such, because of some sense of a strong notion of an I, we also feel possessive of things, saying, this is mine, this is my object, my body, my possession, and so forth. For example, when you see, this is quite clear to us, that we have this kind of a sense of a strong attachment when we possess something. Because when you see some things in a shop, and if that beautiful thing that you actually have noticed, a beautiful thing or something good that you have noticed in a shop, if it fell down on the floor and broke, you would only feel, oh, how sad. But when once you have bought it, and then it drops from your hands and it breaks, then you really feel so sad about it. And there is that is because of the sense of attachment that comes with the possessiveness of the object. And therefore, when you actually understand how things cannot have, similarly, when you think that, when you find that things have no objective existence, external existence, but that the mind itself has some substantial existence, that can, to a certain degree, overcome or undermine your attachment and anger towards the objects. And then, when you understand that things do not have any objective existence, that in turn undermines your negative emotion to a further degree.
Wow.
So as Nagarjuna says, as long as there is grasping at the aggregates, there is an apprehension of the self. So when you are able to confirm that the basis of designation of a person or a self is does not have any objective existence, then you will be able to have a better understanding and insight into the selflessness of that person or of a being. And therefore, so if you say that there is the object of designation, the object or the basis of designation of a person is validly existent, and that in turn gives some kind of a grasping or in ourselves, and so we must destroy all objectification. So verse number 33 says, though not finding an object and so forth, how can then lacking a basis, how can the basis emptiness of a thing stand in front of the mind? So if you are able to confirm that things are merely designated, that they are merely existent by way of convention, then that kind of a grasping, strong, intense grasping at some objective existence can be undermined, can be overcome. Verse number 34.
So from the two accumulations, usually the accumulations of the merit actually act as the main causes to eliminate the obscurations. And the accumulations of the wisdom act as the main causes to eliminate the obscurations, the latents of those obscurations. So in verse number 38, how can offerings made to something lacking a mind give rise to results? Because whether he is alive or has already passed into nirvana. So having done experiment, especially to the scriptures and the teachings from the Buddha, so having seen whether it is free of any contradiction, then we can only come to the point that that scriptural teaching of Lord Buddha is also valid. And from this verse onwards, it is to authenticate the teachings of Mahayana. And in the Pali traditions, usually it presents the Four Noble Truths and the 16 Aspects, and mostly focused towards the meditation on no self. In Thailand, I have a friend who is a bhikshu. He's a very wonderful bhikshu. His name is Buddha Daksa. And he is interested to the selflessness of phenomena. So these schools assert that it is not necessary to meditate on the selflessness of phenomena. So merely by meditating on selflessness of the person, so one will be able to attain the liberation. So this is from verse number 40. But since liberation occurs through seeing the truth, suppose like the Hinayana standard holders, you then object. But since liberation occurs through seeing the Four Noble Truths, what is the use of seeing emptiness? So we can say the main reason to prove, to validate or to authenticate the Mahayana teachings is the following. Sorry. This from verse number 44. Although the Arahat Bhikshus are the foundation of Buddha's teaching, so if the Arahats are the foundation of the Buddha's teachings, so if this Arahats become the foundations without even realizing the selflessness of phenomena, then they cannot be said so. So as long as they are not able to destroy the even the traces of the target to generate the graspings, so they won't be able to realize the ultimate emptiness. And for the afflicted emotions also, generally a few classifications. There is a coarser one, which is normally referred to as the afflicted emotions with its objects and aims. And this is the coarser one. And there's even a more subtle one, which is usually related or which can be even corresponding with the self-graspings, through the graspings of true existence. So unless we eliminate the true graspings, so we won't be able to attain the liberation. So this is another the counter debate coming from the Chittamatran school, that even though these arahats do not have those kind of afflicted emotions, but due to the karma, that they will be reborn to the samsara. So then the Madhyamika school put forward the argument that so these afflicted emotions is of course not the one that belongs to the coarser, but it is the even subtler one, which is linked to the self-grasping, the grasping of true existence. So the verse number 48, ultimately it says this, therefore one need to meditate on emptiness, as the emptiness is coming from the Madhyamika Prasangika school. Verse number 49, if you accept as spoken by the Buddha any speech that has been included in the sutras, then why not accept the Mayana sutras, which for the most part are equivalent to your sutras? And the view of emptiness, it is the ignorance that actually bring us to the cycle of this rebirth, and then the transitory collection, the grasping of the transitory collection, is again can be also eliminated once you realize the no-self. So even you attain liberation and also eliminated all the transitory collections, the grasping of the transitory collections, still you can fall on one side and merely admiring for the peace. And Nagarjuna presents the fundamental wisdom in the 24th chapter, where there is the critics coming from the true existence, the proponents of the true existence, that you are falling on the one side. And in order, when the Madhyamika school explains that, so you haven't understood the purpose of the emptiness. You haven't understand the actual the meaning of the emptiness. So when we speak about the meaning here, so emptiness do have a connotation that has the potentiality, once understand it, has the potentiality to even destroy even its aims or the any objects. And as Nagarjuna says that, since every phenomena is merely by designated, by designation, so therefore this is the true emptiness, and it is also the teachings of the Tibetan origination. And the one having seen the Tibetan originations, so through this we will be able to eliminate suffering, and with that we will be also able to eliminate the origin and attain the cessation and the path and so on. So here So when we speak about the suchness, so the suchness is actually spoken by everyone, even the Chittamatra schools. But we have to speak here the suchness pertaining to the Tibetan origination. So here, this suchness of the Tibetan origination is extraordinary presentation coming from Middle Way philosophy, which is the free of all the four modes of existence, which cannot be refuted by any of those reasonings. And when we speak about the Tibetan origination, so the first category is the Tibetan origination of cause and effect. Then there is the Tibetan origination of part and whole. And ultimately, it is the Tibetan origination of mere designation. So this is the three categories. So first, due to the cause and effect, first, we can generate understanding of the Four Noble Truths, the truth of suffering, truth of origin, and so on. And the third category actually gives us a complete understanding about the truth of cessation, which is the Third Noble Truth. So by the power or the teaching of the Tibetan origination, it has the capacity to dispel the both extremism. So even falling on nihilism and extremism. So as all the things are by nature Tibetan arising, so therefore they do not have an absolute entity. So this is very effective in eliminating the extremisms. And one of the Tibetan scholars, when they explains the meaning of Tibetan origination, the Tibetan term, Denjung, so they have composed a very beautiful verse, which presents this meaning very beautifully. So when the compassion really grows within us, so it forces the Bodhisattva to stay in the samsara. So if one realizes the suchness of Tibetan origination, one will be able to dispel or eliminate all the obscurations. And this will act as a special force to accumulate both merits and the wisdoms. And it will also help to realize the emptiness, dispelling all the extremisms. In verse number 54, emptiness is the remedy to the darkness of afflicted and cognitive obscurations. So how can someone wishing to achieve omniscience quickly not meditate on it? It's a verse number 56. So from here onwards, it teaches on the four mindfulness. And one way of presentation is to keep the body and the consciousness and those things as the basis of the emptiness, and then presents the teaching on four mindfulness. So the first one is the mindfulness on the body, which is on verse number 57. Teeth, hair, and nails are not a self, nor is self the bones or blood. Self is neither monstrous nor pleasant, nor is self limp or purse. Self is not fat nor sweat, neither is self the lungs nor liver. As Nagarjuna presents in the precious garland, that not even the five sensory, but even our mental thought cannot be the point of reference of the self. So he refutes the presentation of the Bhava Viveka, that the consciousness is the point of reference of the self. So the main example or the point of reference of the self cannot be found if you search for it. So it is merely designated. So here the term mere has a special connotation. So the self is like a demon, and the following verses tell us that if the self cannot be found, then what is the self? And the self is merely designated on its aggregates. So even Chittamatra schools, the mind-only schools, even accept that they also presents the teachings on. They also accept the no self, but. But when it comes to the self as something rely upon its aggregates, so here comes the huge difference in determining the subtlety of how the self relies upon its aggregates. And from now onwards, it is how to refute the assertions that is coming from non-Buddhist. It's from verse number 60. And if the mind perceiving sound were permanent, as some just assert, the sound will be cognized at all times. But what is the cognized when bereft of an object to be cognized? By what means could it be called a cognizer? So from this onwards, all the verses are dealing with the refuting the assertions of Samkhya school. Verse number 66, suppose you explain, but its other modes of perceptions are not true, then please describe its own innate nature. Suppose you answer it is a cognizer, well then absurdly it will follow that all persons are one. So in verse number 70, it's again a critics coming from the Samkhya schools that if there is not an independent self, then there cannot be a person who actually engages in the actions and that they can also generate the karmas. So the person that actually engages in the actions and the one who bears the fruits cannot be different from each other. So if there is not an absolute person, then we cannot have same person that actually sow the karma, that that same person cannot bear the fruit. When answering the Middle Way School says that it is only through the continuity of the mind, continuity of the consciousness that experience. So even though it may be two different things, and then what about the consciousness, whether it is the person or not? Then one section of the Chittamatran School accept six consciousness, and one accepts eight consciousness. So even from the Tantra and the Great Completion, when it comes to the Great Completion, of course there is a reference to the eight consciousness, but it is quite different. Verse number 73, the past and the future minds. So the past mind has already ceased, and the future is yet arrived. And so what about the present? So the present mind has to be the point of reference of the self. And if the mind presently arising were the self, when it perishes, there will in fact be no self. Then there's another critic on coming from the Samkhya school on verse number 75. Suppose you ask, if sentient beings do not exist, toward whom could one generate compassion? And in many of the Madhyamaka texts, that the person exists only by popularity or by designation. So we're reading from verse number 77. Because arrogance misconceives the nature of self, suffering increases. You say, but that cannot be undermined. Well, then it is best to meditate on selflessness. A body is neither the feet nor the cuffs, nor is the body the thighs or hips. So Solanus comments that when it comes to the concept of the part and whole, so the whole is usually dependent upon the parts, and the part also in turn is dependent upon the whole. So if that is the case, but then what about the whole where it resides? So if the when the non-Buddhists accept that the whole or the person is not relying upon anything, and one of the school non-Buddhist schools accepts about a primary substance which is different from its instances, so they accept this concept. So how can they come to, how can they ascertain that the whole or the part is not different from each other? In verse number 82, so the following verses where the critics, an answer to refuting the critics coming from the Samkhya school. As the body does not exist either outside or inside the parts, how could the hands and the so forth possess a body? As it does not exist separately from the hands and so on, how could it possibly be truly existent? Thus the body is not truly existent, but because of ignorance, the mind perceiving a self in hands and so forth arises, like the mind perceiving a man in an effigy, because the effigy is molded in the shape of a man. And the verse number 88, from here presents the semblances of phenomena in relation to close placement of mindfulness on feeling. So from here, it's from the four mindfulness, is the mindfulness on emotions or feeling. If suffering was absolute by nature, why does it not undermine our extreme joy? And if happiness exists intrinsically, why does a good taste and so forth not delight someone tormented by grief and the like? So the verse number 91 reads that, so if when the suffering, unpleasant feeling comes, so if the pleasant feeling has to recede or cease, then the unpleasant feeling and the pleasant feeling has to be the cause of the arising of the another one. So next is the touch. So in order to generate any kind of a feeling, whether it's a pleasant or unpleasant, first we need to have a contact with that object or the persons. So the contact can be through the faculties, the eye faculties, and the other sense faculties, and so on. And the verse number 94, yet there cannot be penetration of a particle by a particle. They have no empty space and they are of uniform size. When there is no penetration, there is no co-mingling. And when there is no co-mingling, there is no meeting. Verse number 97, and so like that, when contact does not truly existence, His Holiness comments that even the feeling, also when you investigate further, you even cannot find it. And the same thing is with the case of contact. Verse number 99, nevertheless, some things can be seen and also can be touched through what has the nature of a dream or an illusion. Furthermore, a feeling, because it has arisen simultaneously with the mind, is not perceived by that mind. 102, mind does not exist. A mind does not exist in sense powers, in forms and so on, nor in the space in between. A mind is not inside nor outside, nor can it be found anywhere else. Something that is not the body nor is something else. Neither commingled nor separate in any way, is not a thing at all. Because of that, sentient beings are released in the natural nirvana. So His Holiness comments that the term natural nirvana here actually means that when all the phenomena, when they are subjected to critical investigation, they cannot be found. So it is called natural nirvana. So since things cannot be found when they are subjected to critical investigation, then how can you also come to the conclusion that there is a thing called conventional phenomena? And so for the the conventional phenomena, so the term conventional, we have a few different variations for that. So the conventional of the conventional phenomena is a bit different. So it does mean something truth towards that mind. And that mind here is also a particular, a specific mind, which is the grasping of the true existence. So the conventional truth, so here the conventional again is only truth in the sense of the grasping of the true existent. So the conventional, when we speak about two truths, it is actually, so that conventional itself is not the grasping. So for the things to exist, it has to be conventionally known. So merely by conventionally known does not make the thing existent. For example, a horn or a rabbit can also be an existent in that case. So what we have to need for the secondary is that I have seen it and my friends have also seen it. So merely not being satisfied that it is conventionally known, it is also something related to our daily life. For example, things like the foundational mind as accepted by the mind-only school. So this is a different concept. So they accept the concept of the foundational mind because they need a true, absolute point of reference of the self. So that can be refuted by the ultimate reasonings. So every kind of phenomena, in order to prove its existence, it has to be conventionally known, and it cannot be refuted by another conventional valid cognitions, nor by an ultimate valid cognition. It's one of those comments that, as Chandrakriti says, that things has to be scrutinized or by investigated by seven modes of finding whether the self has an absolute existence or not. So they can be only established merely by conventionally, by conventions, but not by absolute. And verse number 110, when the object of analytical inquiry is being examined, the analytical inquiry has no basis. And because of being without a basis, it does not arise. That is called natural nirvana. And also when it comes to the cognizer and the object of cognitions, so the relation between the cognizer, the cognitions, and the object of cognitions is again relative. And one schools actually accept the cognitions as having cognition with aspect. And when the aspect of that object appears to that mind, and when that mind apprehends that image or the aspect, it is said to be that the mind cognizes that object. Verse number 113, for example, if a man without a child is not a father, then by whom is a child seared? Because in the absence of a child, there can be no father. Tea blessing. So please, so I will continue to read. So we're verse number 115. Well, if the seed is realized by a cognition different from the sprout, by what reasoning is the true existence of the cognition, which is inferred through its apprehension of an object established? So from here is the logic that establish emptiness by eliminating the four possibilities. 116, by direct perception of the conventional world, all causes are seen. After all, the diverse parts of anything like lotus, stalks and so forth grow by means of diverse causes. Suppose you ask, what has produced those diverse causes? Well, a diversity of previous causes. And suppose you ask further, why does a cause have the ability to give rise to an effect? Well, due to the power of previous causes. Verse number 123, and why does he not create continually, since he does not depend on anything else? If nothing exists that was not created by him, on what does he depend in order to create? If the creation depends on other conditions, the collections of the conditions would be the cause and not Ishvara. For when the conditions are gathered, no power can impede the creation. And this is the assertions of the non-Buddhist schools which accept Ishvara as the creator. And if the powerful Lord Shiva, Ishvara, must create lacking a wish to create, it absolutely follows that he is under the compulsion of something else. What if creation is done when he wants, then he is under the power of want. And this non-Buddhist school actually accept the world of with the person with nine different qualities, and the three of them being the pleasant, unpleasant, and the neuter. Verse number 130, if functional things are of the nature of their causes, well, have not functional things already been analyzed? In any case, the causes for you are the very pleasure and so on, but cotton, clothing, and the like do not arise from those. And pleasure and so on arise from cotton, clothing, and the like. Then since these do not exist, pleasure and so on do not exist. Moreover, even the permanence of pleasure and so on has never been seen. Verse 134, and if the gross manifest state is not different from pleasure, then the manifest pleasure is impermanent. So this verse actually tells us about one of the four alternatives of the production, which is to be produced by the same cause sharing the same entity. And the verse number 138. So, when we speak about the valid cognizer, so here the valid cognizer has a connotation of observing or cognizing an existent or a phenomena which is characterized by its own features. So when we eliminate the phenomena by having subjected to critical investigations, actually we are trying to eliminate the true existent phenomena. Verse number 141, therefore, when analyzed in that way, nothing exists ceaselessly. Things do not exist in their conditions, whether individually or collectively. A thing does not emerge from something else, does not abide, nor does it go. So anything viewed as truly existent by ignorance, how is it different from an illusion? So for the reasons of the Tibetan origination, to establish Tibetan originations, so there are a few different reasonings. Verse number 145, reasoning to establish emptiness from the viewpoint of effect. So this is one of the reasons. I think it has also a reference in the 70 verses by Nagarjuna. For a functional thing that is existent, what need is there for a cause? Then again, if that is not existent, what need is there for a cause? There can be no transformation of a non-existent thing, even by means of 100 million causes. How can a thing in that state of non-existence become an existent thing? But what else could be transformed into a functional thing? Since functional things cannot possibly exist at the time of the absence of functional things, when will they come to exist as functional things? Without production of a functional thing, cannot be freed from being a non-functional thing. So through these reasons, it examines the reality of the phenomena. So why does the true existence, the main reason the other schools put forward to prove the existence of the true existence is that the things do seems to have its own existence. And the main reason was by the cause and effect. So since through the causes, through a solid or absolute causes, so the result happened. So these are the main the reasons that the proponents of the true existence schools, such as Chitta Madhura schools, put forward that the things do have a true existence because the compounded things by naturally dependent upon a cause and effect, and a cause is usually needs to have a solid or an absolute existence. Verse number 151, with all phenomena empty in that way, what is there to gain? What is there to lose? Who is there to respect or scorn? 153, upon analysis, the world of living beings is here, that will die here. Who is there who will come into existence? Who is there who has existed? Who is a relative, a friend? 155. Through causes such as fires and festivities, then from the distress and all exertion and disputes, they cut and stab each other, thus passing their lives in tremendous difficulties due to their negative deeds. There as well, with the activities for longevity and health, with hunger and exhaustion, with sleep and harms and likewise, with fruitlessly keeping company with childish people, life passes quickly and in vain, yet analytical wisdom is so difficult to gain. Furthermore, where is there in samsara a means to eliminate the habituated destructions? 164. For example, some people perform ablutions and ablutions. Then they jump into fire again and again. Even though in terrible states of suffering, they believe themselves to be happy. So having under the influence of the grasping of the true existence and having indulged in the attachment and the negative activities for all time, so only through the understanding and the teaching of emptiness can be helpful for these persons. And so here completes the ninth chapter on wisdom, and as it is end of the supplement to the middle way by Chandakriti. So having by the dependent or understanding of the dependent originations through the power of the wisdom and the method, one will be able to understanding of emptiness. And by the power of the wisdom on one side and the merit on the other side, the great practitioners will fly over the great oceans of the practice and reach the enlightenment. And in between this, we will read from the stages of meditation. Yes, well, Unifying method and wisdom, when both are equally engaged, keep still effortlessly. So Acharya Kamala Srila, he is the student of Chandrakshita, who accept the true existence. So therefore, when he speaks about the absence of entity, so whenever he refutes the true existence, when he uses the logical reasonings, he always uses the characteristics of ultimate. On page number 227, what is suchness like? It is the nature of all phenomena that ultimately they are empty of the self of persons and the self of phenomena. And from here onwards, it actually it presents the meditation on the selflessness of persons. And the person is also not different from its aggregates. And the aggregates are also not completely different from the persons. And these expressions actually looks like refuting the person as independent, solitary, and unitary. And when we use the term that the grasping of the self as the transitory collections, so it is actually referring to the person which is being designated among the collection of the aggregates. And some of the schools of the even in Buddhism, they also do, most of them do not accept the self is not completely different from the person, from the aggregates, and they are not able to even consider the aggregate itself as the self. So therefore, they say that the self is inexpressible when compared to the aggregates. So till here is the presentation on the selflessness of person. Therefore, we must conclude that the assertion of the worldly I and mine is wholly mistaken. Meditation on the selflessness of phenomena should also be done in the following manner. Phenomena, in short, are included under the five aggregates. Page number 228. The 12 sources of perception and 18 eliminants. So Chittamatra schools actually abolish the concept of the external existence, and they establish the internal consciousness as empty of true existence. So those Madhyamika schools which follow the same pattern of explanations are called Yogacharya Madhyamika schools. The physical aspects of the aggregates, sources of perception, and physical elements are in the ultimate sense, nothing other than aspects of the mind. This is because when they are broken into subtle particles, and nature of the parts of this subtle particle is individually examined, so no definite identity can be found. So in Chittamatra schools, the presentation of the selflessness of phenomena is rather different from the Middle Way philosophy. This speaks about the absence of the different substantial existence of the object and the mind. So the absence of the absence of the different object and the mind is called the ultimate, referred to as the ultimate emptiness in the Chittamatra school. In the ultimate sense, the mind too cannot be real. How can the mind that apprehends only the false nature of physical form and the so forth appears in various aspects be real? analyze that just like the mind, the nature of all phenomena too is like an illusion. In this way, when the identity of the mind... Similarly, since the mind is not different from them, the identity too is neither one nor many. Therefore, the mind by nature is like an illusion. Analyze that. Just like the mind, the nature of all phenomena too is like an illusion. In this way, when the identity of the mind is specifically examined by wisdom, in the ultimate sense it is perceived neither within nor without. It is also not perceived in the absence of both, neither the mind of the past, nor that of the future, nor that of the present is perceived. When the mind is born, it comes from now here, and when it ceases, it goes now here, because it is inapprehensible, indemonstrable, and non-physical. If you ask what is the entity of that which is inapprehensible, indemonstrable, and non-physical, the Heap of Jewels Sutra states, O Kashyapa, when the mind is thoroughly sought, it cannot be found. What is not found cannot be perceived, and what is not perceived is neither past, nor future, nor present. Through such analysis, the beginning of the mind is ultimately not seen, the end of the mind is ultimately not seen, and the middle of the mind is ultimately not seen. In this way, when the person does not ultimately see the identity of all phenomena through wisdom, he will not analyze whether physical form is permanent or impermanent, empty or not empty, contaminated or not contaminated, produced or non-produced, and existent or non-existent. So if the basis do not exist, so the emptiness which is based on that basis cannot be also exist. Just as physical form is not examined, similarly feeling, recognition, compositional factors, and consciousness are not examined. When the object does not exist, its characteristics also cannot exist. So how can they be examined? In this way, when the person does not firmly apprehend the entity of a thing as ultimately existing, having investigated with its wisdom, the practitioner engages in non-conceptual, single-pointed concentration. So those who do not meditate with wisdom by analyzing the entity of things specifically, but merely meditate on the elimination of mental activity, cannot avert conceptual thoughts. So His Holiness comments that this phrase actually refutes those assertions from the earlier masters that mere eliminations of mental activity is the true meditation. The Cloud of Jewels Sutra also states, one skilled in discerning the faults engages in the yoga of meditation on emptiness in order to get rid of all conceptual elaborations. Such a person, due to his repeated meditation on emptiness, when he thoroughly searches for the object and the identity of the object, which delights the mind and distracts it, realizes them to be empty. When that very mind is also examined, it is realized to be empty. When the identity of what is realized by this mind is thoroughly sought, this too is realized as empty. It has been explained very clearly that it has been explained very clearly that through mere elimination of mental activity, without examining the identity of things with wisdom, it is not possible to engage in non-conceptual meditation. And His Holiness comments that this verse actually tells us that the concentration has to be realized on meditating on and understanding the emptiness, not focus on the basis. Sorry. You are free from expressions and with single-pointed mental engagement. When you meditate on the special insight of understanding the wisdom, first we need to understand the emptiness very well, the ultimate nature of the things. For example, that the things do not have any absolute existence when subjected to critical investigations, though they have only an in appearance, they appear as soul. So according to the presentations coming from Chenju, so things, when further investigated, do not have anything merely apart from merely mentally designated. So without losing this clarity and this understanding in your mind, then we have to see how much we can meditate and understand. So having meditated the shamatha first, so taking that strength into place, and we have to further place our mind to understand the ultimate. So when you continue that, gradually your understanding of the ultimate truth or emptiness will improve, and the clarity of that mind will increase from there on. You are free from expressions, and with single-pointed mental engagement, you automatically enter into meditation without exertion. Thus, you will clearly meditate on suchness and abide in it. While abiding in that meditation, the continuity of the mind should not be distracted. When the mind is distracted to external objects due to attachment and so forth, such distraction should be noted. Quickly pacify the distraction by meditating on the repulsive aspect of such objects and swiftly replace the mind on suchness. If the function of the mind becomes unclear and starts sinking, or when there is a risk of it sinking due to being overpowered by mental torpors or sleep, then as before, quickly attempt to overcome such dullness by focusing the mind on supremely delightful things. Then object suchness should be held in very tight focus. At times when the mind is observed to be excited or tempted to become distracted by the memory of past events of laughter and play, then as in the earlier cases, pacify the distraction by reflecting on such things as impermanence and so forth, which will have subdued the mind. Then again endeavor to engage the mind on suchness without applying counter forces. If and when the mind spontaneously engages in meditation on suchness, free of sinking and mental agitation, it should be left naturally and your efforts should be relaxed. If effort is applied when the mind is in meditative equipoise, it will distract the mind. But if effort is not applied when the mind becomes still, it will become like a blind man due to extreme dullness, and you will not achieve special insight. So when the mind becomes dull, apply effort, and when in absorption, effort should be relaxed. When by meditating on spiritual insight, excessive wisdom is generated and calm abiding is weak, a mind will waver like a butter lamp in the wind, and you will not perceive suchness very clearly. Thus, through this process, a yogi should meditate on suchness for an hour or a half session in the night, or one full session, or for as long as is comfortable. This is the meditative stabilization, thoroughly discerning the ultimate as taught in the Descent into Langa Sutra. Then, if you wish to arise from the concentration while your legs are still crossed, think as follows. Although ultimately all these phenomena like identity, conventionally they definitely exist. If this were not the case, how would the relationship between cause and effect and so forth prevail? The Buddha had also said, things are produced conventionally, but ultimately they lack intrinsic identity. Sentient beings with a childish attitude exaggerate phenomena, thinking of them as having an intrinsic identity when they lack it. thus attributing intrinsic existence to those things that lack it confuses their minds and the wanter in the cycle of existence for a long time. For these reasons, I shall endeavor without fail to achieve the omniscient state by accomplishing the unsuppressible accumulations of merits and insights in order to help them realize suchness. So from here, how to meditate on this? Meditate on the wisdoms, which is backed by a huge collections of the merits. If you act thus, your meditative stabilization will be actualized, that emptiness that possess the best of all qualities. The Sutra of Dialogue with Ratnakuta states, donning the armor of loving-kindness while abiding in the state of great compassion, practice meditative stabilization that actualizes the emptiness possessing the best of all qualities. What is the emptiness possessing the best of all qualities? It is that which is not diverse from generosity, from ethics, from patience, from effort, from meditative stabilization, from wisdom, nor diverse from skillful means. Therefore, bodhisattvas should also cultivate generosity and other skillful means, and not only emptiness. The extensive collection of all quality sutra also says, O Maitreya, bodhisattvas thoroughly accomplish the six perfections in order to attain the final fruit of Buddhahood. But to this the foolish respond, bodhisattvas should train only in the perfection of wisdom. What is the need for the rest of the perfections? They rebuted the other perfections. Maitreya, what do you think of this? When the king of Kashi offered his flesh to the hawk for the sake of a pigeon, was it a corruption of wisdom? Maitreya replied, this is not so. The heel of Gaya hat, Sutra says, the bodhisattva path in short is twofold. The two are skillful means and the wisdom. The first among the supreme and glorious also says, the perfection of wisdom is the mother and expertise in skillful means is the father. The sutra of the teaching of Vimalakriti also says, what is bondage for bodhisattvas and what is liberation? Upholding a life in the cycle of existence, devoid of skillful means, is bondage for bodhisattvas. But to lead a life in the cycle of existence with skillful means is liberation. Upholding a life in the cycle of existence, devoid of wisdom, is bondage for bodhisattvas. But to lead a life in the cycle of existence with wisdom is liberation. Wisdom not conjoined with skillful means is bondage. Wisdom conjoined with skillful means is liberation. Skillful means not conjoined with wisdom is bondage, but skillful means conjoined with the wisdom is liberation. Sorry. If bodhisattvas cultivate mere wisdom, they fall to the nirvana desired by hearers. Thus it is like bondage, and if they cannot achieve non-abiding nirvana. So wisdom separated from skillful means is bondage for bodhisattvas. Therefore, just as a person chilled by the wind seeks the comfort of fire, so bodhisattvas cultivate the wisdom of emptiness along with skillful means to eliminate the wing of wrong view. So. Shiro So wisdom separated from skillful men is bondage for bodhisattvas. Therefore, just as a person chilled by the wind seeks the comfort of fire, so bodhisattvas cultivate the wisdom of emptiness along with skillful means to eliminate the wing of wrong view. But they do not endeavor to actualize it as the hearers do. The 10 qualities Sutra says, O child of good family, it is like this. For instance, a person who is thoroughly devoted to fire, who respects it and regards it as guru, will not think because I respect, honor and venerate fire, I should hold it in my both hands. This is because he realizes that to do so will give him physical pain and cause mental discomfort. Similarly, bodhisattvas also are aware of nirvana, but also do not try to actualize it. This is because he realizes that by doing so, one will be turning away from enlightenment. If they rely merely on skillful means, bodhisattvas will not transcend the ordinary level, and thus there will only be bondage. Therefore, they cultivate skillful means along with wisdom. But the power of wisdom, bodhisattvas can transform even the disturbing emotions into nectar, like poison under a tantric spell. There is no need to express the goodness of the generosity and so forth, which leads to naturally elevated states of existence. The Heap of Jewel states, Kashyapa, it is like this, due to the power of mantra and medicine, a poison may not cause death. Similarly, since the disturbing emotions of bodhisattvas are under the power of wisdom, they cannot cause them downfalls. Therefore, due to the power of skillful means, bodhisattvas do not abandon the cycle of existence. They do not fall to nirvana. Due to the power of wisdom, they eliminate all objects misconceived as truly existent, and therefore they do not fall into the cycle of existence. Thus they attain the non-abiding nirvana of Buddhahood alone. The Unraveling of the Thought Sutra also says, I have not taught that someone who is not concerned for the welfare of sentient beings and who is not inclined to realize the nature of all composite phenomena will achieve unsurpassable and perfectly accomplished Buddhahood. Therefore, those interested in Buddhahood must cultivate both wisdom and skillful means. While you are meditating on transcendental wisdom or while you are in a deep meditative absorption, you cannot engage in skillful means such as practicing generosity. But skillful means can be cultivated along with wisdom during the preparatory and post-meditative periods. That is the way to engage in wisdom and skillful means simultaneously. Moreover, this is the part of bodhisattvas in which they engage in an integrated practice of wisdom and skillful means. This is cultivating the transcendental path that is thoroughly imbued with great compassion, focusing on all sentient beings. And while practicing skillful means, after arising from meditative absorption, you practice generosity and other skillful means without misconceptions like a magician. The extensive collection of all quality sutra states, just as a magician endeavors to let his creation go, since he already knows the nature of his creation, he has no attachment to it. Similarly, the three worlds are like an illusion, which the wise Buddha knew about long before he knew the sentient beings in these three worlds and had undertaken efforts to help them. In this way, become familiar with generosity and other skillful means that are dedicated to unsurpassable and perfectly accomplished enlightenment, having the essence of emptiness and great compassion. In order to generate the ultimate awakening mind of bodhicitta, so having by the power of practicing such paths, which is conjoined with the skillful means and the wisdom, and for the temporary, we will have a more happy mind without under the influence of the distorted conceptions. and also our altruistic minds and the practice will enhance and improve. Those who become familiar with compassion, skillful means and awakening mind of bodhicitta in this way will undoubtedly excel in this life. Buddhas and bodhisattvas will always be seen in dreams and other pleasant dreams will also occur and appreciative gods will protect you. There will be immense accumulation of merit and insight at every moment. Disturbing emotions and other bad states of existence will be purified. You will enjoy much happiness and mental peace at all times and the great many beings will cherish you. Physically too, you will be free of disease. You will attain supreme mental facility and thus you will achieve special qualities like clairvoyance. So as it is stated in the Katakata Paragade, so the following lines are present in similar to the Heart Sutras mantra. In this way, a person who has entered the first level, later on the path of meditation, familiarizes himself with the two wisdoms of the transcendental state and the subsequent wisdom in skillful means. In this way, he gradually purifies the subtlest accumulation of obscurations that are the object of purification of the path of meditation. And in order to achieve higher qualities, he thoroughly purifies the lower spiritual levels. All purposes and objectives are completely fulfilled by entering the transcendental wisdom of the Tathagatas and by entering the ocean of omniscience. In this way, by gradual practice, the mind stream is thoroughly purified. So having elevated from the ordinary ground, so one attains the level of Aryas. So with this, one attains the path of the first ground. The unraveling of the thought too reads, in order to achieve those higher levels, the mind should be purified just as you refine gold until you realize the unsurpassable and perfectly consummated Buddhahood. Entering the ocean of omniscience, you possess jewel-like qualities to sustain sentient beings. So having attained the first spiritual ground, so we will continue to achieve the following, the second and third and so forth. The individual then becomes the embodiment of compassion, possessing various skillful means that function spontaneously and work in various emanations in the interest of all wandering things. Wandering beings. In addition, all marvelous attributes are perfected with total elimination of all defilements and their latent potential. All Buddhas abide to help every sentient being. Through such realization, generate faith in Buddhas, the source of all wonderful knowledge and qualities. Everyone should endeavor to actualize these qualities. So from here onwards is how to attain the result state of the Buddhahood. Entering the ocean of omniscience, you possess impeccable jewel-like qualities to sustain sentient beings, and this fulfill your previous positive prayers. The individual then becomes the embodiment of compassion, possessing various skillful means that function spontaneously and work in various emanations in the interest of all wandering beings. In addition, all marvelous attributes are perfected with total elimination of all defilements and their latent potential. All Buddhas abide to help every sentient being. Through such realization, generate faith in the Buddhas, the source of all wonderful knowledge and qualities. Everyone should endeavor to actualize these qualities. The wise distance from jealousy and other sins. Their thirst for knowledge is unquenchable like an ocean. They retain only what is proper through discriminations. The second part of the stage of meditation by Acharya Kamashila is here completed. So in the colophon of the first stages of meditation, it is written as in a concise manner, it is completed and being requested by the Emperor Tisong Dezen. So here completes the middling stages of the meditation. So we will complete the remaining part of the Bodhisattva's way of life. So it's yet to be three now. Page number 198, first I will have a tea. So please look at the page number 198, the 10th chapter of dedication. So the book distributed to you is very tasty. I received a transmission on the Paramahansa teachings by Gyan Rinzen Denpa. And when I request for teachings, sometimes I offer Shila some tea, and Rinpoche used to, before taking the tasting the tea, he will take the butter and apply it on his nose, because it is the Tibetan tea. So for sweet tea, there is nothing like this I can do. So the stages of meditation, this text tells about the foundations, the basis, and basis on that, the practice of the path, which is the practice of compassion and bodhicitta, and followed by the shamatha and special insight. And the result of such practice, what kind of the qualities that we can, realizations that we can generate, for example, the path of accumulations and so on. And this is a very beautiful presentation, and we have to keep in our mind, as presented in the Heart Sutra, the Gathagatha Paragathe, the progress of the five paths. So first, how we have to attain the path of accumulation is very beautifully presented in the stages of the meditation. So this text actually gives us a very clear overview, the map of how to progress and attain these paths. So at the time of the beginning to until the enlightenment, how we have to take the journey with the help of the wisdom and the method. And please, we have to keep this in mind, and we have to be sure that this is the correct order and the sequence. And so this is very important. And now, so the 10th chapter, dedication. And this chapter is usually we recite as a part of the 8 prayers. Through the virtue of having composed this book, A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, may all beings come to engage in the Bodhisattva's conduct. May all beings everywhere, So what the suffering can be, your physical suffering or any kind of mental sufferings. May all beings everywhere, plagued with the sufferings of the body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. For as long as they remain in cyclic existence, may their mundane happiness never decline, and may all of them uninterruptedly receive waves of joy from bodhisattvas. May all embodied creatures who throughout the universe experience hellish realms come to enjoy the bliss of Sukhavati. May those feeble with cold find warmth. May those oppressed with heat be cooled by the boundless waters that pour forth from the great clouds of the Bodhisattvas. May the forest of razor sharp leaves become a beautiful pleasure grove, and may the trees of knives and swords grow into wish-fulfilling trees. May the regions of hell become places of joy, with vast and fragrant lotus pools, beautified with the exquisite calls of wild ducks, geese and swans. May the heaps of burning coals change into heaps of jewels. May the burning ground become a polished crystal floor. And may the mountains of the crushing hills become celestial palaces of worship filled with sukhadas. May the rains of lava, blazing stones and weapons from now on become a rain of flowers, and may all battling with weapons from now on be a playful exchange of flowers. By the force of my virtues, may those caught in the fiery torrents of acid and their flesh eaten away, revealing their lily-white bones, obtain the bodies of celestials and dwell with goddesses in gently flowing rivers. Why are the henchmen of Yama, the unbearable vizirs and vultures afraid, through whose noble strength is joy brought upon us and darkness dispelled? Looking up, they behold in the firmament the radiant form of Vajrapani. Through the force of their joy, may they be free from evil and find his company. When they see the lava fires of hell extinguished by rain of falling flowers mixed with scented water, immediately satisfy the wanter whose work this was. In this way, may those in hell behold Padmapani. Friends, don't be afraid, but quickly gather here. What need is there to flee when above us is the youthful Manjugosha to dispel our fears, the tender Bodhisattva who protects all living things, through whose might all suffering is removed and the force of joys abounds. Behold him in an enchanting palace, resounding with hymns sung by 1,000 goddesses, with the terrors of 100 gods being offered to his lotus feet, and a rain of many flowers falling on his head, the eyes of which are moist with kindness. Upon seeing Manjugosha in this way, may those in hell cry out loud with joy. Likewise, having seen, due to the roots of my wholesome deeds, the cool and the sweat-smelling rains falling from joyful clouds created by Bodhisattva Samantabhadra and Sarvanirvana Vishkambi, may all beings in hell be truly happy. May all animals be free from the fear of being eaten by one another. May the hungry ghosts be as happy as the men of the northern continent. May they be satisfied by a stream of milk pouring from the hand of the noble Lord Avalokiteshvara, and by bathing in it may they always be cooled. May the blind see forms, may the deaf hear sounds, may just as it was with Mahadevi. May pregnant women give birth without pain. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food, may the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy, may the fallen find new hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their illness, and may every disease in the world never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and those bound to be free. And may the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting one another. May all travelers find happiness everywhere they go, and without any effort, may they accomplish whatever they set out to do. May those who sail in ships and boats obtain whatever they wish for, and having safely returned to the shore, may they joyfully reunite with their relatives. May troubled wanderers who have lost their way meet with fellow travelers, and without any fear of thieves and tigers, may their going be easy without any fatigue. May those who find happiness themselves in trackless, fearful wilderness, the children, the aged, the unprotected, those stupid and insane, be guarded by beneficent celestials. May beings be free from all states of non-leisure and be endowed with faith, wisdom and kindness. With food and excellent conduct, may they be mindful throughout their lives. May all beings be without want for wealth, just like the treasury of space, and without it being the source of dispute or harm, may they always enjoy it as they wish. And in Tibetan, the monastic community. So when it comes to the case of the Bhikshuni vows, so it is, we have to follow the Vinaya patterns, the Vinaya rules and regulations. And this is not something that I can decide. Actually, it is very much necessary to have Bhikshuni to complete the four members of the Buddha's Buddha's four members. But we have to rely upon a proper rituals and the rules and regulations. In Tibet also, in history, there have been some instances where some masters have conferred the Bhikshuni vows. Whether it will be a pure and a completed Bhikshuni vows or not, it is still a dispute. And so, since we have to follow the current Vinaya systems and the teachings that we have in practice today, and in the earlier, we have also done many meetings and the conferences and discussions on this matter. And we have also did discussions with the bhikshus from Taiwan and the Burma and so on. But till now, we have not come to a confirmed point. But the thing that I can confirm and I can come to a decision at this point is that the nuns community should also study the Buddhist philosophical texts. And many nunneries took these initiatives wholeheartedly. And this year we have the Geshe-ma graduates. And are any of the Geshe-mas around here? Any Geshe-mas around here? I saw one somewhere out there. I think they're all hiding. I cannot see. We did a grand ceremony, and I think in the Tibetan history, this is the first time that the Geshe-mas obtained, the nuns obtained Geshe-ma degree, having studied the Buddhist philosophical studies for over 20 years, and having expertise and gain the full understanding of the Buddhist teachings. And I have awarded the Geshe-ma's certificates. And this is something that I can make a decision. But when it comes to the issue of Bhikshuni vows, this is something that I have to go accordingly to the Vinaya traditions. And unless we come to a common opinion within all the Bhikshuni's traditions, it will be difficult. In Tibet, we also have a term called Lamaism. So some people may criticize us that Tibetans are introducing many new systems. So this may not be good. So all the followers of the Vinaya traditions have to come to a common opinion and a decision here. I heard that in Vietnam, there's a traditions still in practice of conferring the Bhikshuni vows. And some of the abbots from the Chinese traditions are a little bit doubt over this possibility. So still now, we have been doing a lot of research. So the Geshe-mas are already there. And I'm sure that in the years to come, many more Geshe-mas will graduate, having studied the Buddhist philosophical studies. And even in Tibet, and the nunneries all over the Himalayan regions will also come up with new Geshe-mas in future. And even in China mainland, there are many nuns. And also the community of the monks is large. And I've seen that some temples in China are even paying interest to study the philosophical texts. And I'm really very grateful. And I, as I used to say, we all have to work hard to be a 21st century Buddhist, that someone can explain the basis, the path, and the result, teachings of the Buddha based on the reasons and rationality. And this can be really be a great service to the preservations and the promotion of Buddhist teaching. Verse number 44, may nuns be materially sufficient, abandon quarreling with each other, and be unharmed. Similarly, may all ordained ones never let their morality weaken. Whenever I wish to see something or even wish to ask the slightest question, may I behold without any hindrance the Lord Manjugusha himself. In order to fulfill the needs of beings who reach onto the ends of space, may my way of life be just like that of Manjukosha. For as long as space endures, and for as long as living beings remain, until then may I too abide to dispel the misery of the world. The teaching of the Buddha has to be granted to the intelligence and the wisdom which has the potential to investigate. So Manjugosha is the deity of the wisdom. We normally refer to him as the god of wisdom. And we all usually recite the praises of Manjugosha called Ganglomma and pray to him. Whether it's a self-generation or the front generations of the Manjugosha. And having recited the Ganglomma prayers, and if you recite the Arabasa mantra, it will be very helpful, especially for those who are stammers, and also very helpful. So everyone pay attention, usually, but still Ganglomma prayers is only very short prayers. And there is only one verse that who comes in the youthful form and who eliminates all the three afflicted emotions and dispel the three darkness. So when we speak about dispelling the darkness of the three worlds, and I prostrate to the Manjugosha, so here the darkness of the three worlds is not the external world, but the afflicted emotions within us and all the sentient beings. And having recited this verse once, and if you recite one full mala of the Arabasa mantra will be very helpful. Verse number 54, in order to fulfill the needs of beings who reach onto the space of space and subspace, may my way of life be just like that of Manjugosha. And the verse number 55 is the very strong prayers and dedication for as long as space endures and so on. And the benefit of the awakening mind and the negativities of the self-cherishing attitudes. And so the awakening mind is the only one which can be a benefit to self and others. And having taught that, we have to cultivate the bodhicitta as much as possible. And that, as we have read earlier, having ride the horse of awakening mind, then we will progress from the happier to the happier places. So who will refuse to practice such a great bodhicitta? And verse number 56, may all the pains of living creatures ripen upon myself. And a similar expression is also coming from Nagarjuna's precious garland. And through the might of the Bodhisattva Sangha, may all beings experience happiness. May the teachings which are the sole medicine for suffering and the origin of every joy be materially supported and honored and abide for a very long time. I prostrate to Manjugosha, through whose kindness wholesome minds ensue. I prostrate to my spiritual masters, through whose kindness I develop. Here completes the chapter on dedication. Shandarakshita actually gives the guidance and the instructions to the Tibetans while translating the text that there should be two translators, one Tibetan translator and Indian master. So they have to sit together and translate texts. And this is a very beautiful and a wonderful guidance from Shandarakshita. And therefore, in nowadays, when some scholars do some research, they come to the conclusion, to the common conclusion that the Tibetan translation seems to be the most refined and the best translations till now. And the teachings of the Buddha on the base path and the result teachings were actually the one which is really almost at the same par with the Sanskrit origins, or the original Sanskrit texts. And the Indian translator Sarvajana Deva and the Tibetan translator Bendi Pelzik. And it was also re-edited in a later period by the Indian abbot Sumati Kriti and Tibetan translator Gelong London Sherub. So till here, the preliminary teachings for the 34th Kalachakra initiations is completed. And the teachings on middle volume of the stages of meditation and a guide to the Bodhisattva's way is completed. And the most important part is that having printed the text and distributed to you, and you have the book in your hand, and those who have not got the book, you must make effort to get a copy of the book and keep it with you all the time. And so it's of course it may be very good instead of reading a lot of different books, it's even better to read these texts and think about their presentations. And in order to gain further understanding about these texts, if you recite some Devi Yogas or the mantras, it will be helpful. Without having any deep understanding, merely by using or moving your lips will not be much effect. Of course, there are some benefits if you recite the mantras, but not so strong. Even it will be similar to those non-Buddhists that they consider the Veda verses very important, that merely listening to the Veda's verses are considered very important. So we will be similar to that. So as part of the introduction of the Buddhist teaching, I have given the transmissions of these two, and I also have the transmission lineage, and you have well received the transmission lineage. And especially for the guide to the Bodhisattva's way of life, I've been practicing for a long time, and I read it very often. And usually when I do my daily prayers, I remember the verse in my mind and also recite and think about those verses. And all of you also use this text as your normal use, as your routine meals that you eat every day. So till here, we have completed the preliminary teaching for the 34th Kalachakra. Tomorrow is a break, and after tomorrow is the preparatory ritual ceremony for the actual initiations. And for the actual first one day will be for entering the mandala, and then the next will be how to confer the initiations. Having entered the mandala, there will be about 11 vast initiations. And there will be the high and the Vajra higher initiations. And after that, usually I used to do a small longevity ritual initiation. And I thought that I thought to give one of the Avalokiteshvaras permission. So at the end of those cultural initiations, we will offer our Avalokiteshvara permissions. We have arranged the precious pill also here. Even the text is different, but your visualization will be same. So along with this Avalokiteshvara's permissions, it will be also a part of the ceremony for your long life. So someone who is and some old elderly people are very stubborn. I am a very simple and open-minded old man. And of course, when I get age, of course, I get tired easily and more often. So even anyway, today, so I'm very feeling very fine and in very good health. And all of you, please live in very happy. And for the actual initiations, you have to receive the actual initiation yet. So that's all for today. Sanyu chabar sunso la. Sanyu chabar yin sunso. The dark ceremony is usually in the morning, but I'm sure there will be an official announcement soon.
They are going to have a meeting here. They're going to have a meeting, and I would like to greet you and congratulate you for this meeting. So we are gathered here, and then we make friends with each other and we become close to one another. And so that is the main cause for friendship and harmony amongst ourselves. So when you become friendly with each other and closer feeling to one another, that's a cause for harmony. Whereas if you stay distant from one another, and then like we did in Tibet, we will not have that experience. But today, the communication and transportation are easier. So in the past, we couldn't do it often, but occasionally, like between meeting between Sakya Dakti Rinpoche here and me. And so here, in, after coming into exile, we have been we have had many opportunities and occasions to meet more often. And as I said before, if you could actually make yourself familiar, the different traditions of Tibetan Buddhism, Buddhist followers could make the familiar with the tradition and the texts of other traditions, it would be good. Otherwise, remaining separate, I mean, unrelated to the other traditions, calling yourself Sakya Luka Yunyingwa and not studying other texts from the traditions other than yours own. So it would be good. Otherwise, if, for example, in according to the Thurgil practitioners and worshippers, they say that if, for a Nyingma practitioner, if they kept even a text of other, for a Gelugpa practitioner, if they kept a Nyingma text, even a Nyingma text in their house, the Gelbo Shugden will harm, Thurgil will harm them. That's not good. Is it more beneficial in, if we live in harmony amongst ourselves without mixing up the traditions, but living in harmony, or to, I mean, all the traditions of Tibetan Buddhist, I mean, Buddhism have the same teaching, the Nalanda teaching, which comprise both the Tantra and Sutrayana, and then we have the pinnacle of the philosophical views, such as which is the Master Nagarjuna's philosophical view. That, I mean, we follow the same Nalanda tradition, but and therefore, if we could also learn from one another's traditions, it would be good. Otherwise, sectarianism is not good. So, in what's happening in Arab today is something that actually opens our eyes, because in that region, although people, the Muslims, are followers of the same teacher, the founder, Muhammad, but because of some differences, they actually cause conflict with between the Shia and Sunni. And so that's not good. So although we follow the same Nalanda tradition, the same followers of the same teacher, like I mean, we don't find it good. And so similarly, in the past, when we were in Tibet, we remained isolated from, I mean, the different traditions more or less remained isolated from one another. And now that when we, in retrospect, we find that it is really important to be careful about sectarianism. And then in Tibet, there was this tradition of Rime tradition, non-sectarian. For example, in Kham area, there is Kenze Wangpo and so forth, have started that, the non-sectarian tradition. And regarding myself, I have teachers like Kenzo Rinpoche and so forth who were already Rime followers, not only after coming to exile, but even before 1959, inside Tibet, for example, in the case of Trichu Rinpoche, who was a Mi'kmaq practitioner, was already a Rime follower because he received teachings on the Lamrim teachings. And then regarding the Dalai Lamas, like Gendun Drup and Gendun Gyatso, the second Dalai Lama, was a non-sectarian practitioner. In Yangpo Church's biography of the second Dalai Lama, the second Dalai Lama was called Rimebe Gyawa Shasemowa, which means the yellow-haired Lama, who was non-sectarian. And so this tradition of Rime, non-sectarianism, was already there in practice, even in Tibet. And therefore, we need to examine and check which one is better,
to follow non-sectarianism or sectarianism. And then accordingly, I mean, if we should not remain isolated and narrow-minded, but we should be harmonious with each other and follow non-sectarianism. It is much better. And so your organization's meeting, the fact that you are holding the meeting is very good, but it's not enough just to have a meeting and then come up with some resolution in the end. But the people involved in this non-sectarian organization should study one another's texts from one another's tradition. If a follower of the Sarma tradition says, "Oh, the Nyingma texts actually smell of Nying, an old tradition," and the others say the Sarma tradition smells of the new tradition, and so forth, that's not going to help. And therefore, it's better to keep in mind what I have said with regards to studying one another's tradition well.